Case number 15-5030, United States of America versus TDC Management Corporation, Inc. et al. Appellants. Mr. Hamilton for the appellants, Mr. Valdez for the appellee.
Mr. Hamilton.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is David Hamilton and I represent the appellant WDG in this case. There is a very narrow and incontrovertible way for this court to reverse and remand back to the district court. Under the Foreign Debt Collection Procedures Act, a property interest can be garnished only if it is substantial and non-exempt. The district court's decision can be reversed because the court's conclusion on substantial was incorrect. But importantly for this issue, the case can be reversed and remanded because the district court failed to make any kind of finding on the exempt issue. That's a critical part of the statute. It's a limitation on the enforcement of the Federal Debt Collections Procedures Act. And the court's omission, which really does require remand, is enough to send this case back. The record will also permit the court to reverse outright. The government did not prove and will never be able to prove that the decedent defendant Conrad Montz's interest in property of the garnishee was either non-exempt or substantial. The statute in section 3014A2B refers to tenant by the entirety interests. The government's first and second motion for a disposition order and the government's expert's affidavit may have misled the court because even after discovery, the government wrongly asserted that Montz's interest was as the sole owner of the shares of WDG. Indeed, the entire premise for the government's first request for a disposition order was that Montz was the sole owner of the shares of WDG, which was wrong, and the government never corrected that record before the district court. The court's opinion, though, correctly identified that Montz had no individual interest in shares of WDG. WDG shares were owned by the common law fictional protected interest by Conrad and Barbara Montz, husband and wife, as tenants by the entirety. Reference back to section 3014 should have led the court to conclude that the interest was exempt.
You didn't make that argument below.
Your Honor, we did make that argument below.
Where?
It's in our brief, and we made the argument.
I've got your brief.
The statute requires the court to conclude under section 3207.
Where in your brief did you make this argument?
When we laid out the elements of the statute. Are you talking about the exempt argument, Your Honor, or the substantial argument?
Well, I'm not sure that I understand your argument, but to the extent that you're arguing that the property couldn't be garnished because it was held as tenancy by the entireties, I've got your brief here, and that argument doesn't appear.
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the case that we cited, the Morrison case, that talks about the interest of the tenants by the entirety, that is one example of where we discussed the issue of substantial property interest. The court's decision clearly addressed the substantial property interest. We just briefed it to say that the court was wrong. We also cited the Export-Import Bank case from the Second Circuit. In the Export-Import Bank case, the Second Circuit concluded that the interest there, which was an intermediary bank's interest in electronic funds transaction, was not substantial under the statute. And by analogy, this interest, Conrad Montz's future contingent interest.
That's a different argument. The argument as to whether it's substantial under the statute and is property is a different argument than whether or not it can be garnished because of the language in 3205A that refers you back to state law. And then you have to argue that state law under the District of Columbia doesn't allow it to be garnished.
I agree with that,
so
Your Honor.
You've got to lay all of that out. And I don't see that anywhere in your brief.
Well, Your Honor,
beside the fact that you waited 3 years to object and the court found that you forfeited your rights but went ahead and heard your arguments anyway.
WDG did raise this issue before the district court. It is in the court's decision, and it's in our brief, Your Honor, about whether the Foreign Debt Collection Procedures Act has a limitation by state law. That state law interest here for the District of Columbia is the tenants by the entirety interest. Because that's a limitation on the Foreign Debt Collection Procedures Act, we believe that the district court decision was wrong on the conclusion that there was a substantial property interest. It doesn't meet the definition. There is no definition of substantial, as the court knows, in the statute. But by analogy, the export-import decision concluded that that intermediary bank's interest in an electronic funds transaction was not substantial. This is even more attenuated than that.
So you only get to this question of how the tenancy by the entireties operates, if I'm understanding things correctly, if you first get past a threshold argument that you can't even get to the tenancy by the entireties unless you pierce the corporate veil. And so there is that threshold question, which I just want to bracket for a second.
Well, the government always asserted that there was a piercing the corporate veil argument, but the government never brought a separate claim to pierce the corporate veil against WDG or Conrad Mons' wife, Barbara Mons.
Right. So this is an argument for you. I'm just saying that your argument for tenancy by the entireties says that because of the nature of a tenancy by the entireties, even if you could pierce the corporate veil, you can't get to this property because of the way a tenancy by the entireties works.
Correct.
I'm just bracketing the question that there's a threshold issue about the piercing the corporate veil, whether that has to come first. Now, skipping forward to tenancy by the entireties, the language of the statute says, and I was puzzled by that. I don't think you quoted this in the brief. It says, co-owned property shall be subject to garnishment to the same extent as co-owned property is subject to garnishment under the laws of the state in which such property is located?
Yes.
And is that the language you're relying on? Or where?
The language we're relying on, going back to the elements of the statute, includes under Section 3014 the description that tenancy by the entirety property is exempt under the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act. So if it's exempt under the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act, it means that the property can't be attached.
Is that language in your statutory addendum?
It's in the statute in Section 3014A2B.
Is it in your addendum?
Yes.
Where is it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, it would take me too long to find it. I'd be happy to tell you.
It's not in your addendum.
The statute is recorded in the addendum. The statute is briefed as well in our briefs.
I guess I didn't see 34. It sounds like you're relying on 3014, and I didn't see that in the addendum.
Again, the argument is that the district court is required to make a finding that the property is not non-exempt. Non-exempt is not defined in the statute, but in Section 3014A2B, it describes property as exempt. It's not defined, but it's a categorical description of property that's exempt. If that property is described as exempt in 3014A2B, the district court should have concluded that it was exempt for purposes of the disposition.
What's the language of 3014A2B? I don't think I have the language in front of me. I don't think it's in the statutory addendum. So can you just tell me what the language is?
There's a long part in A, but it says, any interest in property in which the debtor had immediately before the filing of such application an interest as a tenant by the entirety or joint interest, or an interest in a community estate to the extent that such interest is exempt from process under non-applicable bankruptcy law. And that takes us to the District of Columbia's state law, if you will, or the district's application of it. And that is a description of property that is exempt under Section 3014.
And what did you cite the statute in your brief?
No.
I believe we cited the
does it appear below, nor did Judge Bates respond to it because it wasn't there.
But Section 3205 requires a finding that there's non-exempt property. And the only way that you get to non-exempt here is the use of the word non-exempt in the statute. Mm-hmm. So the point here is that non-exempt is described in 3014. We did not brief that, correct, Your Honor? I agree with that.
So you're relying instead on the provision of the Federal Act that refers one to state law.
Yes.
As opposed to the provision of the Federal Act, which would simply say if it's a tenancy by the entireties, that's the end of the matter.
Either way, I think
you would have won under the first one.
Either way,
I think had a better chance. But it wasn't there. It didn't elicit a response from the government, and it wasn't in Judge Bates' opinion. And Judge Bates doesn't overlook arguments that are made to him.
Understood, Your Honor. Either way, I think we find ourselves in a position where the court's decision didn't address the non-exempt issue. Perhaps we didn't raise it under 3014, but the court's required to make a finding under 3205.
The court made a finding.
The court
footnote 5 of the district court opinion says a judgment debtor can elect to have certain property exempted. 28 U.S.C. Section 3014. No election has been made in this case.
Yes, that's a procedural mechanism, Your Honor. The debtor did not elect to pursue that route. That's correct. But under 3207, the court is still required to make a finding that the property is non-exempt.
3205 or 7? You switched numbers here, haven't you?
3205C7.
Okay.
Is the disposition order statute.
And I didn't see any place where you made this argument or cited this in your district court brief, which I have right here in front of me.
The court overlooked it in the opinion. We did not brief it, but we're raising it as a requirement to send it back because the court did not make the finding under 3205.
Why shouldn't we hold it? It's forfeited.
Your Honor, the court was required to make that finding. I think it's just a plain error of law.
Let me ask you a different question, which is on the tenancy by the entireties argument you're making now presupposes that the way the government gets to the property is through Mr. Mons. Now, the judgment could have been executed against either Mr. Mons or TDC.
Yes.
Right? So there's an entirely separate route, which is to go through TDC.
Yes.
And whatever's left of TDC.
Yes.
So your argument doesn't get to that possibility.
TDC dissolved in 2003. There are no assets. There's nothing to be garnished there.
Well, how do we know that? Why weren't the assets for TDC then, as I understood it, Mr. and Mrs. Mons were a tenancy by the entireties with respect to TDC? And so then whatever was supposed to go to TDC then ends up with Mrs. Mons. No?
Yes. Possibly. I don't know that there ever were any assets. We did not go back that far.
If it did end up with Mrs. Mons, wasn't it still before the garnishment?
What ended up with Mrs. Mons, Mr. Mons died in 2009.
I'm thinking now about TDC here.
TDC, whatever was there, presumably passed to Mrs. Mons. The record did not include any kind of discovery or any kind of writ of garnishment on TDC because it was long gone by the time the government applied for writs of garnishment
in
2008.
That was the point I was just making or asking about. Isn't TDC out of the picture because its dissolution precedes the garnishment?
It was out of the picture, yes. I'd like to go back to one of your earlier questions, Your Honor, if I may, which is how do you get to the tenancy by the entirety question? The FDCPA clearly has to honor and oblige state law. And state law here, the District of Columbia law, says that this interest is a tenant by the entirety interest is not a garnishable asset. And I think that's the answer to the question that you were seeking before.
You wanted to start off on substantial interest.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I thought you were arguing when you started, you wanted to talk about substantial interest.
Well, substantial, it, because of the nature of that interest, the tenancy by the entirety interest, Mr. Mons had no interest
is your
at all in WDG. WDG just had an investment interest.
What do you say to the district court's statement that he had an equitable interest?
Mr. Mons had no interest in WDG. That's the way that we view it. He had an interest only through that fictional interest as tenants by the entirety. The tenants by the entirety had an interest in the investment assets, not even the operational assets.
But
of
he was
WDG.
A shareholder, right?
He was not an individual shareholder. Remember that the fiction is that there's a husband, there's a wife, and there's a tenants by the entirety, which is a third type of ownership interest. He did not have any kind of direct interest as a shareholder. That's the point that I was making earlier, that the government misled the court from the beginning in its disposition order, saying that the Conrad Mons was the sole shareholder of WDG. So to answer your question, Judge Ginsburg, I think the answer on substantial is that kind of interest, you could call it exempt, but the way that the Export-Import Bank dealt with it was to look at the interest and say it's so remote, it's so contingent, it's so attenuated that it doesn't rise to the level of substantial property interest. So there are two ways to get to this, through the substantial door or through the exempt door, is the point of the argument.
What's wrong with the language that I quoted earlier, which this language actually is in your addendum, and although I'm not sure you quoted in your brief, but this says, co-owned property shall be subject to garnishment to the same extent as co-owned property is subject to garnishment under the law of the state in which such property is located.
I don't know that there's anything wrong with that, but joint tenancy by the entirety interest is a variation of co-owned property.
It's one type of co-owned property.
It's one type of co-owned property. And under the District of Columbia law, in the Morrison case, the court specifically addresses that a joint tenancy by the entirety interest, which might be a subset of common ownership, is not garnishable.
Right. And so if it's true that under D.C. law, a tenancy by the entireties is not subject to garnishment, and this statute says, as a matter of federal law, we look at co-owned property in the way that the state in which the property is situated looks at it.
Yes.
Then that's a route.
Right.
But yeah. I don't think you quoted that statute in your brief either, and I'm just wondering, is there a problem with that logic?
No, there's no problem with the logic. The point of the arguments here are that the court has got to address substantial and non-exempt. And for non-exempt, there seems to be a clear answer, and I know Judge Wilkins, we may disagree about whether we briefed it or not, but the non-exempt is absolutely referred to in Section 3014, which is a procedural mechanism that wasn't exercised here. But it's the only place where tenancy by the entirety interest is defined as non-exempt in the FDCPA. See, my time is up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Daryl Valdez, and I'm an assistant United States attorney representing the United States in this case. Your Honors, if I may, just real quick, if I want to point out, when TDC, WDG, and Conrad Monser served with the writ of garnishment, they were specifically given a form called a request for hearing or transfer, in which they are to set out what the specific, if there's any exemptions that they claim. And that goes to the court, and the court then is under the procedures, they're supposed to make their objection, they're supposed to state specifically what their objection or the exemption is, and then they have the burden of proving that under 3205C5 it's the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act, not the Foreign Debt Collection Procedures Act. So nobody filed this form. None of the three entities filed this form at all. At no time did anybody raise the exemption to the judge in the district court. And what the judge had was he had information that TDC was a joint tenant property. He knew that WDG was a joint tenant property. And if I may clear something up real quick, counsel says that that the United States misled the district court about whether Monts whether or not they were joint property or not. That is clearly not correct. In our pleadings, throughout our pleadings, we note that both entities are joint tenant property. Under District of Columbia law, joint tenant property that incurs a debt, you may then use joint tenant property to satisfy that debt. We made it clear there was no issue about this before the district court. Nobody said, oh no, this is an issue and here's some distinctions here. No, it was just, oh, this is joint tenant property. Well, he knew that, and he knew that TDC was joint tenant.
And Monts never appeared at all.
That is correct.
Before he passed away.
Another thing I need to correct is TDC did not dissolve. It is not a dissolved corporation. Rather, all the assets were distributed. So the final $300,000 or so was paid directly to Mr. and Mrs. Monts, and then the company just sits there. It has not been formally dissolved. It's still there, legally, but it's just an empty shell. Also, if I may point out, Your Honor, the definitions that counsel points to in Section 3014 of the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act does not create the exemption. That provision applies if the responding parties can't agree, if the responding parties are husband and wife and they can't agree on what is and is not exempt property. If you read the very first introduction paragraph, it talks about when responding or objecting and setting out your exemption, this is what you need to do. And if they can't agree, then you go to the paragraph that they cite, that they rely on. That does not say that it automatically exempts that property. But in this case, it wasn't at issue before the court, wasn't brought up before the court, and nobody brought it up as something that needed to be addressed.
What about the language in 3205A that I was quoting earlier?
That language, Your Honor, well, first of all, that language is somewhat, as you noted, a little ambiguous. Are they talking about that it's exempt or that we can't, once we get the property, we have to separate it according to the percentage that the states recognize? Some states recognize that entity property is owned, although indivisible, it's 50-50. Some states have a contribution type analysis. And so it's confusing as to whether or not that applies to that or not. In this case...
Well, let me ask it this way. Sure. Suppose that D.C. law establishes that the government in this situation, or a creditor generally, can't go after a tenancy by the entireties in order to collect on a debt owed by one of the tenants. Because of the nature of the tenancy by the entireties just doesn't permit that. Let's just suppose that D.C. law stands for that proposition. You might tell me it doesn't, but let's just suppose it does. Then this statute says co-owned property shall be subject to garnishment to the same extent as co-owned property is subject to garnishment under the law of the state in which such property is located. So it seems to me that this language doesn't seem ambiguous to me in that respect. It seems to suggest that if what I hypothesize D.C. law to be is what D.C. law is, then a creditor can't go after the property of the joint.
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, in this case, it's irrelevant because D.C. law also says that joint property may be attached or otherwise used to satisfy a debt or judgment incurred by the joint tenancy.
And well, but that's a debt. I don't know what you're reading from.
I'm reading from Tretzky versus Tretzky, 450 bankruptcy, 247, and that's 252.
Case. Okay, maybe I don't understand that quote, because what that quote sounds like is that if the debt's owed by the joint tenancy, well, of course you can go after the joint tenancy. But right. The question here is that the debt's not owed by the joint tenancy.
It is, Your Honor. It is TDC with the joint tenancy.
You're talking about going through TDC.
Well, TDC, it doesn't matter. They're both jointly and severally liable. So TDC.
But I'm focused on the argument that the district court wasn't talking about TDC. The district court was talking about Mr. Moss. Well,
because TDC as an entity is basically a shell, and it's there, and it has been drained of its assets long ago. So there was nothing to go after, but...
So put just bear with me for one second, okay. If you would. So put aside TDC. Okay, look, there's two ways in which the government could collect. There was Mr. Moss, and there was TDC. Let's just assume away TDC for a second, because as I understood the district court's opinion, it wasn't talking about TDC. It was talking about Mr. Moss. The way it gets to Mr. Moss is through WDG. A lot of acronyms, but the way it gets through to Mr. Moss through WDG. Now, as to WDG, it seems like this statute is pretty germane because WDG also is a tenancy by the entireties. And what this statute says is, as I understand it, you can't go through a joint tenancy like this one to get to a debt owed by Mr. Moss because it's a joint tenancy. And as I've hypothesized, D.C. law says you can't get at the debt of an individual debtor through an enterprise that's a joint tenancy in which that individual debtor is one constituent part.
Okay. And again, I'm going to have two responses to that. First one is that nuance was never brought up before the district court for him to even consider. What he had was point number two, TDC, you can't ignore TDC. It's there, and it is a joint property.
Okay, so I am ignoring TDC.
Okay, I would say,
Let me just say this. Just bear with me on this hypothesis.
Okay,
let's just assume TDC is just not part of this. I get your argument that you can't completely ignore it, and maybe we'll bring it back in.
Okay.
But I'm just saying, for purposes of the way the district court looked at it, which was, as I think, to disregard TDC and just talk about Mr. Moss, on that axis, it seems like this statute is a complete answer. I get that you have a fallback argument that says, well, fine, we lose on that. We still can get it through TDC. I'm just trying to establish, on the way that the district court looked at it, which was to disregard TDC and look at Mr. Moss, it seems like this statute tells us, well, you can't get at Mr. Moss through an enterprise in which he was a tenant by the entireties because of the nature of that animal. It's something that's indivisible. And so it may be true that one of the tenant by the entireties owes something, but you can't get at that tenant, an asset of that tenancy by the entireties in order to retire a debt owned by one of those tenants.
If we ignore that.
Yeah.
And as you say, that it is just Mr. Mons, I would say that is a valid argument to make,
okay,
in which we would be allowed to respond to and research. However, it was never made. That wasn't made. The court wasn't given that argument below. It wasn't told that that was the
argument. I thought that was their whole argument. Now, as far as I can tell, they never cited this statute or this language of the statute, which I don't understand why not. But I thought that was kind of their whole argument is
their whole
it's
argument.
A tenancy by the entireties. You can't get at Mr. Mons through this because he's part of a tenancy by the entireties.
As my understanding, their argument below was that since Mons died in 2009 and it was a tenancy by the entirety, it all goes to Mrs. Mons and therefore there's no property left for the government to take. Therefore there's nothing left because now this $8 million judgment and everything that's WDG is now Mrs. Mons and the U.S. can't have that. And our argument back was no, the garnishment survives the death of Mr. Mons because it was served, it was executed and perfected before his death, and therefore it attaches to the property and not to the defendants, and therefore the question is the status of the property, in which then somebody needs to step in and claim that property. The only people that stepped in and claimed that property was WDG here, and just saying it's a corporate asset of ours, and it belongs to Mrs. Mons. That was their argument below. It was not, they did not make that nuance of if you're only going through Mr. Mons, you can't have it. Because, because it was understood, TDC is a joint tenancy. Therefore, you can grab joint tenant property to pay that debt.
Can I ask this other type of question, because it's also looming in the case, although we didn't get into it much earlier, but as I understand the district court's logic, and it's the argument that you presented to the district court, the way you get at this asset that's owed to WDG, which is a corporation, is that Mr. Mons has an equitable interest in the corporation's assets because he's a shareholder. And D.C. law treats that as an equitable interest, and therefore the fact that the property is owed to the corporation doesn't matter. We look through and we look directly to Mr. Mons because he's a shareholder in that corporation. He has an equitable interest in that asset,
correct,
and therefore the debt owed to the government by Mr. Mons is something that be collected on through an asset owned by WDG.
Right.
That just seems to me, doesn't that just fly in the face of just the most basic principle of corporate law, which is that we don't treat an asset of the corporation as if it was an asset of the shareholder?
Well, it's not how that is, John. In fact, we cite two D.C. corporate law that says that a shareholder has a future interest. It's not a present interest. They have a future interest, so they hold the stock. And if and when the company dissolves or folds, any assets remaining after paying the debts is paid out to its shareholders.
So let me ask you that. A future interest is part of it, but let's suppose that that I owe a debt to the government. I'm a shareholder. I own Walmart shares. Walmart has a payment coming to it from some other commercial dispute. Can the government get its hands on that payment on the theory that I owe the government money? I'm a shareholder in Walmart. I have a future interest in Walmart equity. Therefore, the government has access to Walmart's...
You're missing the second part of the test, okay, Your Honor. That's the substantial interest.
Really? So you think that this all goes to substantial... It's because I'm only one shareholder in Walmart, and there's all kinds of other shareholders. That's where this all comes down.
No, Your Honor. I'm saying, yes, it comes down to substantial. It doesn't come down to the fact that you're a shareholder. And first of all, there is evidence in the record. Their own expert witness admits that Mr. Mons was a shareholder, first of all, because he says that he wasn't. He was. He was a shareholder. But secondly, with his wife, I mean, they were joint tenant. All right. The D.C. law,
I seem to be contradicting yourself. You said he was a shareholder.
He was.
But then you said with his wife, the joint
they
tenancy.
They were both shareholders?
Or was the joint tenancy the sole shareholder?
No, it was not, Your Honor. He was given stock by the corporation, or by the company. Mrs. Mons was given stock by the company. And the stock was given to them as joint tenants, or tenants
by the party. In each case.
Correct.
So neither of them had stock.
Well, I'm sorry?
So then neither of them had stock. They had an interest in the joint tenancy. They were joint tenants in all of the stock.
Well, they had stock, correct.
As a joint tenancy.
Under the law, they have joint tenants, right. And that, in this case, Your Honor, they had stock, and they had it, so they had a future interest in the corporation. Okay, that's fine. And the court said they have a future interest. It's contingent, but that satisfies the wording of the statute. Now the question is it substantial?
Right, right.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, in this case, this is a subchapter S corporation. Mr. Motz was using the money or any losses, and there were losses throughout the year, as the government's expert showed, and he was using those losses to offset his income every year, his and Mrs. Monson income every year. And so, therefore, he actually was using their income.
What if he was misusing that?
I'm sorry?
What if he was taking that money from WDG? As Hirsch found, he was making transfers to himself and to related corporations, correct?
Correct.
But is it the fact that he was doing that that counts, or is it or does it count only if that was authorized under D.C. law?
No, just the fact he was doing that. If he was doing that and there was no oversight, as in this case, no corporate oversight by the board or anybody.
There was a board of three at the time.
I'm sorry?
There was a board, correct,
yeah,
of three persons.
They only met rarely
But they followed the legal requirements to the extent of having a board.
Correct.
Right?
But the board never reviewed these loans. These loans were directed by Mr. Monts. He said, this money goes here, this money goes there. And there was
that was authorized by the board.
What's that?
What if that was authorized by the board?
Well,
not loan by loan, but a delegation to him as president to make transfers to at will.
Well, again, Your Honor, that at will shows, and if he's also a shareholder, falls within the wording of Dry versus U.S., and that is the power to channel an asset in the hands of another warrants the conclusion that
does that power mean the lawful power to do so or the actual power which may not have been authorized?
We're not saying that his transfer of these loans was unlawful. We're not saying that. That was never said. And in fact, that was their response to us.
Well,
that's part of what they even do.
You would be saying if you were arguing the piercing alternative here, you would be saying they were unauthorized, they disregarded the corporate formalities, all of the things you always say about piercing.
We never said they were unauthorized, Your Honor. We never said unauthorized. We said they were unreviewed by the board. That doesn't mean unauthorized.
So they might have been authorized by the board.
They might have been, but that doesn't make it
a factual question you'd have to tease out in the piercing context.
In the piercing context, well, first of all, the court never reached it, and I don't think
exactly.
It's a problem.
But I understand. That's why you may have another shot at this.
In this case, Your Honor, you can't say it was authorized when there was absolutely nothing from the board minutes or anything that showed that the board reviewed it.
All right, so all we know is he moved this money around seemingly at will.
Correct.
To related parties and to himself.
Correct.
And that, you say, shows that he had a substantial interest in whatever money was remaining there.
It shows that he had the power to channel assets under Dry. That makes it substantial.
He had the power.
Yes.
And Dry, was that power one that would be necessarily and ordinarily incident to just it being a corporation and his being a corporate officer?
Well, in Dry, it was this guy's own personal is inherent.
So
it doesn't tell us anything about whether the ability to move money at will is determinative or even relevant to substantiality.
Well,
when it's a corporate asset.
Well, considering since the fact that showing that the property is exempt is on them. I mean, it would be incumbent upon WDG to show they had given him
what drives this entire line of questioning, it just seems to me, is that your argument that you made at the district court and that the district court accepted was that you don't need to pierce the corporate veil in order to get at an asset of the corporation when the debt is owed by somebody who's assumed to be a shareholder of the corporation. There's a question of whether the person's a shareholder to begin with, because maybe it was just a joint tenancy. But let's assume the person who owes the debt is a shareholder in the corporation. The argument that the district court accepted at your urging was that, well, even though the asset is owned by the corporation and the debt is owned by a shareholder to the corporation, we can get at that asset to retire the debt of the shareholder. And it just seems like that's the entire reason for having corporate law is that that can't happen. Because the entire reason for having corporate law is that there's a difference between what's owed by a shareholder and what's owned by a shareholder and what's owned by a corporation, unless you pierce the corporate veil.
Well, no, Your Honor. And in fact, that is where Dry, Bess, and Kraft.
But Dry wasn't a corporation case.
No, but Kraft comes along that says, look at.
Kraft wasn't a corporation case.
No, it wasn't, Your Honor. But what they say is that
is there any case that involves a corporation that says even though the asset is owned by the corporation, the creditor can get at that asset to retire a debt owed by a shareholder of the corporation.
Your Honor, give me a second. I think that, well, we have the, let me see what the Second Circuit case was. Give me a second. But if I may, Your Honor.
Because that just seems like there's a case called United States versus Best Foods, Supreme Court case, which basically says we don't ordinarily construe federal law to overturn settled principles of state corporation law. And the most settled principle of state corporation law is that there's a difference between an asset owned by a shareholder and an asset owned by the corporation itself. So you don't just commingle them and pretend they're the same thing.
Okay. If I may, Your Honor, and Kraft says that once you find out, is this a bundle of sticks that we call property, and in this case there's a future interest, there's a bundle of sticks called property, we ignore any state limitations upon that bundle of sticks. In applying a Federal Collection Procedure Act or a federal collection statute, we ignore that. And then
it was
the
tax statute.
Wasn't
it the tax statute? Not the debt statute?
Correct, it was. But their language was very broad when they said, when looking at collection statutes. And the procedures they set out is also broad and makes sense, even in this respect, as to how it's applied and how we determine if something is property and if there's a substantial interest. When we look at the substantial interest, we do not look at the limitations upon corporate law unless that is written in the federal statute. And there is none here. None was argued. The only limitation that was argued here that they're arguing now is the joint tenancy. And if I may, Your Honor, when we're talking about the control of that money and who used that money and who had direct access to it, the money or the losses were used by both Mr. and Mrs. Mons to offset their income. Okay. So therefore, if you're saying, well, we're trying to use just Mr. Mons to show that he had control over this joint property, no. The joint family, the joint tenancy, had that control over the joint property using it to their benefit.
Is WMG an S corporation?
It is an S corporation, correct. So they could
hardly surprising that they were flowing through the taxes.
And that's the thing, is that's kind of what makes it more substantial under the federal statute, as well as the fact that he was moving money around willy-nilly, but also the fact that he was able to take it and take immediate benefit
Then your position ultimately, it sounds like, is that although corporate formalities can be honored in many instances in the context of a S corporation, the particularities of S corporations means that there's always a substantial interest held by a shareholder.
And I think it means that you run that risk, correct?
Okay, thanks.
And just because the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act was meant to make it easier for the United States to collect, and so that we don't have to run into all these barriers that private debtors run into, and in fact, that was the distinction with the other cases where the private debtors were trying to use it, and the court said, no. The federal Congress can give the federal government the power to supersede the state protections.
But insofar as you're arguing that the interest here is substantial because Mons could move it at will, and he could move it at will and take advantage of the location, for instance, for flowing through the tax losses, which applies to all S corporations, seems to me you're substituting federal tax law for D.C. corporate law in determining whether there's a substantial interest.
And the answer is yes, that's what Kraft says. We do. That's
well,
how
Kraft
we do
didn't.
Federal law supplants state limits.
The tax statute, and so it's not that surprising that it turns on the tax law.
Right.
This is not a tax statute.
Correct.
It's a procedural statute that says go by D.C. corporate law.
And the reasoning in Kraft has been adopted in the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act by district court, by the 11th Circuit and the 2nd Circuit. And they say that it does apply because it is so general that in the procedure it fits hand in glove with the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act.
I think the problem with your position is that the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act has language in it that's not in the statute, the IRS statute that was at issue in Kraft, namely this language in 3205A that says that the garnishment is still subject to whatever the state law says the power is to garnish property. And that language is nowhere in the statute that was at issue in Kraft, right?
I'm sorry, 3205A, you said?
It's the sentence that we were talking about
yes.
for a while. Co-own property, I think. Is that what Judge Wilkins said?
Yes. Right. Yeah. But again, that's co-owned. That's not corporate. And in this case, there was co-owned property. And TDC was co-owned property. The joint tenancy was receiving the benefit and was using the assets of WDG to offset its income. It still all fits. I mean, it fits in with D.C. law that says joint tenant property may be used to satisfy the debt created by the joint tenancy.
Okay.
Well, it sounds like you're at least accomplishing by indirection what you would accomplish by direction if you could pierce the veil.
Possibly, yes, but I think that if you read the district court's opinion, it is, and I don't mean to be trying to butter up the judge in that case,
that would be unprecedented.
Right. But it is genius in its simplicity and its directness. And it is the direct application of the statute. And he took the statute and he went step by step through that statute and how it applied to this situation. And he said, this is property. This is property subject to garnishment. The government
gets it. What he said was, it's substantial because of the future interest, right? And because of a state case saying that a shareholder has an equitable interest.
No, Your Honor, he said it's property because of that. It's substantial because of the additional information with respect to the usage of that property.
And that was the factual tissue taken from the Hirsch Declaration about how Vermont's moved money around.
Correct. Which they admit that he moved money around. They only had problems with the semantics. We said it was loans. He said it was transfers. We noted that they were writing off bad debts. He said, oh, no, those were losses. So the facts were uncontroverted. The only thing that was disputed was the adjective.
Well, the admissibility of the declaration.
Well, and the court, I think, accurately says, look, I disagree on the representation that the expert is stating the opinion. He says, I think the evidence may support this, and here is why, in his opinion. But as the judge says, he can parse through that, and the case law supports him on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamilton, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Make 4 points very quickly. The Kraft case has been limited in so many ways that it just doesn't apply here. Export-import, Sinreich, Schlossberg. Another, at the risk of citing cases not in the brief, but trying to get it right, there's a case by Judge Easterbrook in the Seventh Circuit called United States versus Rogan. And there's a Fifth Circuit case from 2015 called Alashi, E-L-A-S-H-I. In Alashi, the court made a distinction between the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act and the Multiple Victim Restitution Act and told the applicant, if you go down the path of the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act, you're not going to be able to recover this interest through a garnishment because the joint tenants buy the entirety. But you're able to recover it under the Multiple Victim Restitution Act, MVRA, because it's a substantial statute with substantive rights allowing you to make that collection. And that's the difference between Kraft and what we have here. This is a procedural statute with no substantive rights created in property. As to the issue about ownership, I'd point to the court to the Office of People's Counsel case, which is a District of Columbia case. That's also addressed in the Rogan case. Rogan finds that there's no property interest because I think it was Judge Ginsburg pointed out that the interest in the corporation, or Your Honor did too, an interest in the corporation is different than the interest in the investment asset. The Office of People's Counsel case makes that distinction. Third, a lot of this argument has been effectively going down the piercing the corporate veil path. I think the district court effectively engaged in a veil-piercing argument against no standards to adopt the affidavit of their expert and hold it up as the benchmark for having conclusions that that WDG or Mons did something wrong is effectively a veil-piercing conclusion. I would point out at Appendix 612 that the affidavit from our expert concluded that the majority of the assets belonging to Mr. Monson were jointly owned property that was owned with his wife. That was tenants by the entirety conclusion that pervaded through that affidavit. That affidavit also established that these were ordinary corporate transfers of property, paying of intercompany loans. This is a management company with development projects underneath it. This is common practice in this industry, and that's what our expert concluded, and the court ignored that. Last, I'll point out that this business about TDC being part of this is perplexing. At A136 in the application for writ of garnishment, it's an application for a writ of garnishment upon property that was held by WDG for the debtor Conrad Mons. I have yet to figure out how TDC gets into this argument, and I don't know that it's correct to say that TDC was owned as tenants by the entirety by Mr. and Mrs. Mons. We never really had discovery on that. That was a late emerging issue. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case submitted.